And our final speaker this afternoon is Suzanne Landy, who is also a doctoral candidate in epidemiology at the UNC Chapel Hill Gilling School of Global Public Health. She's going to talk to us this afternoon about predictors of suicidal ideation in Beninese adolescents. Her research interests include health outcomes of contraceptives, adolescent health, and vaccine safety. And prior to enrolling at UNC, Ms. Landy worked as a research associate at the Institute of Medicine, and she earned her MPH from George Mason University and a BA from Bryn Mawr College. Suzanne?
Hi, everyone. Can you all hear me? Working. Good. So thank you for coming to the session this afternoon, and thank you to the speakers who went before me for some really interesting presentations. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about a project that I've worked on looking at predictors of suicidal ideation in adolescents in Benin. And this started out as a school project during my master's degree, and we're hoping to take it a little bit forward. I have no relationships to disclose at this time. And before I get started, I just want to acknowledge a couple of people who helped out with this project. Drs. Jacobson and Palms are two professors at George Mason University who developed the assignment that this project is based on. And then Liz Cromwell and Becky Nauman are two classmates with me at UNC Chapel Hill who helped me run my SAS analysis. So to provide some background, as many of you may know, suicide is a serious cause of mortality worldwide, and it's become an increasing health threat over the past 45 to 50 years. We found that it's the second leading cause of death for adolescents aged 15 to 19 years old, and a large majority of suicides are estimated to occur each year in low and middle income countries. But mortality data is not available for many developing countries, so we could be underestimating the burden of this. Some risk factors for adolescent suicide in the literature include bullying or violent victimization, social conflict, traumatic events, mood disorders such as depression or anxiety, and depressive symptoms. And there's little research conducted on this in developing countries. So to get more background in this issue, we conducted a systematic review last year in September 2012 using Medline. We looked for peer-reviewed literature on suicide and bullying and violence that was published between 2002 and 2012, so within the last decade. We found 15 journal articles on violence or bullying as risk factors for suicide in Western Africa, and many of them also included information about mood disorders and depressive symptoms, so we looked at those too carefully. And we didn't find any publications focusing on suicide specifically in Benin at the time. So from there, we moved on to a secondary data analysis, and we used publicly available data from the Global School-Based Student Health Survey. This is a school-based survey that's developed by the WHO and receives technical assistance from CDC. And what they do is, to determine the sample, it's in a two-stage cluster design. They start with a selection of schools in the countries, and then they randomly select classes to provide the survey to. And the survey is administered to students on a like a Scantron sheet. So there aren't any interviewers actually conducting the questions. They just fill the sheets out. So the GSHS was conducted in Benin in 2009, and they received almost 2,700 responses from students. So with this data, our objective was to evaluate predictive factors for suicidal ideation in this population of adolescents. We use a multivariate logistic regression conducted with a dichotomous outcome. So there is a question on the survey that asks, did you ever seriously consider suicide? And you can answer yes, no, or don't know. And so we dichotomize it as yes, no. We conducted the analysis in SAS 9.3, and I'll present the descriptive statistics and the results of our regression. So the first table, I want to show you a little bit of the frequencies and proportions in our sample. So you can probably see that the majority of the sample is male, about 65%, and also a large proportion are age 16 years old or older. So we evaluated a couple of different questions on this survey. So the first question was, during the past 12 months, how many times were you physically attacked? And you can see that most people hadn't reported being attacked at all, and we have some sparse data for 8 or 9 times, 10 or 11 times. Not many people answered for those options. And then the second question, during the past 30 days, on how many days were you bullied? Again, we have that sparse data problem where we only have a few respondents for like 10 to 19 days or 20 to 29 days. So we use these two questions as our independent variables evaluating violence and bullying. And then we also wanted to look at this mood and depressive symptoms in the sample. So we took two questions, the first one being, during the past 12 months, how often have you been so worried about something that you could not sleep at night? And they could answer never, rarely, sometimes, most of the time, or always. And also the question we used to sort of evaluate depression was, during the past 12 months, how often have you felt lonely? And again, they had the same options. And so finally, the last question, during the last 12 months, did you ever seriously consider attempting suicide, which was our dependent variable? And you can see that 22% of students said yes, that they had seriously considered suicide in the last 12 months, which is actually pretty high. I think the average is maybe 10 to 15%, and we didn't see many other country surveys that had anything that's high for percentage. So we performed our logistic regression, and we evaluated the predictive value of the questions I presented to you. So the first one I'll present is, and I'm really sorry, the table kind of got too big. And it says down there that the model includes age and gender as covariates, and we're reporting the odds ratios, the 95% confidence intervals, and the p-values for everything that was significant. So what we found is that there were increased odds of reporting ever considering suicide for those who were attacked 4 or 5 times or for 10 or 11 times. And like I said earlier, there's a little bit of a sparse data issue. So you can see that the confidence interval is a little bit wide for 10 or 11 times, which is probably just due to the fact that not many people answered in that way. And for bullying, we found that there were increased odds if you were bullied 10 to 19 days, 20 to 29 days, or all 30 days. And again, for some of these, such as for 20 to 29 days, with the 5.1 odds ratio, we can see that the confidence interval is fairly wide too. And I forgot to mention, I'm just going to go back to the earlier table, that the missing values for bullying, we had 8% missing data for that question. So that was something of interest to us. Okay. And then we, again, evaluated for the worrying and the feeling lonely. And we can see an interesting pattern that the odds ratios do increase as you report feeling more worried or more lonely. And these were all significant. So we can see that, for example, if you felt like you were so worried that you couldn't sleep at night, that you had 4 times the odds of considering suicide as compared to those who never reported feeling that worried. Because of the sparse data problem I mentioned before, we decided to rerun another analysis where we dichotomized being attacked and being bullied. So we just, you know, crunched all the responses together, and we evaluated it for if you were ever physically attacked in the last 12 months, or if you were not. You were or were not. Okay, dichotomized. So we can see that the odds were 1.5 times higher for those who reported being attacked, and we found the same odds ratio for if you were bullied in some way, you had 1.5 times the odds of considering suicide in the last 12 months. So just to summarize, that students who reported feeling lonely or being so worried that they could not sleep at night were at increased odds of considering suicide as compared with the students who did not feel lonely or worry in the survey. And that being physically attacked in the last year was a significant predictor, as well as being bullied in the past month. So our analysis did find these significant predictors, and they're consistent with what we know about risk factors for suicide. Some of the strengths of the analysis were that we had few missing values for the question of ever considered suicide. Most students actually answered that question. And we had a large sample size that allowed us to detect these associations. Some limitations, like I mentioned before, the proportion of missing values for bullying was 8%. So we might not have a full picture there. We might not know the extent of bullying in this particular population. This is a result of secondary data analysis. So the data was collected and cleaned by WHO and CDC, so we don't have a sense of what happened during the surveys. We don't know if things were miscoded, and that's just a pitfall of secondary data. And it is a cross-sectional study, so it limits our ability to evaluate temporality. So we don't know if students felt lonely before they considered suicide or if they were considering suicide before they were bullied. We just can't know that in this. So for our next steps, we're hoping to do some additional analyses in Western African countries that this survey has also been conducted in. And it does vary. The surveys do vary in the questions that they ask and have answered. So we'll have to take a look at that and maybe to get a little bit more context to these numbers because it's really just kind of analysis right now. We don't know why the proportion of suicidal ideation in this population was so high. So we'd like to learn a little bit more about that. And here are my references. And thank you. Here's my contact information if you need it. Stay up here. Okay.
Four very interesting presentations. The floor is now open for questions. You might want to come up and.
So I agree, and I'm sorry I forgot to mention this, that one of the limitations might be...
Just repeat the question.
Oh, yeah, sure. So you were asking about... Well, I clarified that it's been in the country in Africa, and you asked about the language issue, that Benin is a French-speaking country, and you asked me to comment on cultural and spirituality factors. So I will say that there is a limitation that it is a French-speaking country. The survey was conducted in French, I know, but we did not look at literature published in French because we aren't fluent in it. So if we take this further and can invest in it, then we'd like to sort of expand it to French literature and look at what's available there. I can't comment on the role of culture just because you know this is kind of numbers without context. So we just ran the analysis, and we're hoping to learn more about that as time goes on because it's just very interesting that there was such a high prevalence of suicidal thoughts. So if anyone has any information they'd like to share with me, I would be absolutely welcome to hear it. Is that good?
No, fine.
Okay, thank you. Sorry.
It would be interesting to know if they actually included those kind of questions on the questionnaire.
Yeah, it's important to include when you talk about the
yeah.
culture. And it's a new phenomenon, mental health
and spirituality, yeah.
Well, not spirituality, but mental health, mental illness, something very, very good.
Mm-hmm. There's a question here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is definitely a possible possible explanation for these interesting results. I can't comment on the characteristics of adolescents outside of schools in this country. I think that the WHO tries very hard to come up with a representative sample, but it's never guaranteed. So it's definitely something that we would like to look into. Thank you.
I have a question for Dr. Alderman. It was really interesting that you're actually asking the people what they see as what can they do and what they can't do in terms of, to me, I see it as part of the meaning of health in a lot of countries. Can I do what I need to when I want to? And I was wondering, do you work with any manufacturers of prosthetic limbs for some of these people so that they can increase their functionality and their sense of health?
I wish. Before I answer it completely, I'd like to thank my mentor and one of my co-authors, Dr. Teresa Betancourt, who taught me much of what I know. We're a very small NGO, and we keep our mission really tight because if we don't, we're not going to do anything very well. We partner with people, though, to do things like this. And right now, CBM is doing some of this, aren't they?
Yeah, they're
NGOs. Yeah, around that area, yeah. And we have partnered with people because, as you know, well, as you may know, in Gulu, the landmines were really prevalent there, and a lot of the people that were involved were children. And that's a problem by itself, as you know, because you've got to keep, as a child grows, you have to keep. So we do it, but we don't do it very well.
Come and talk up here, please. And just repeat the question.
Okay. So hopefully I got it right. To speak in terms of, within the context of Ghana, about the issue of stigma, and I think Ankafal, it might also be a prison, but there is a specific outpatient psychiatric hospital ward there.
So.
Yeah, it's not the nicest, but I think that you can ignore stigma against mental illness. Is a huge issue in Ghana. We actually did a qualitative study looking at health workers at the psychiatric hospitals, and it's not just at the patient level. It actually extends to those that work in the hospital. So one, I remember, nurse was saying that she made a point not to disclose where she worked because people thought that just from being in the context of being around psychiatric patients that it was rubbing off on her. So I think when we talk about barriers to improving treatment for mental illness in Ghana, that is one that cannot be ignored. One thing that the Ministry of Health is trying to do now is promote plans to do more of community health workers to try to overcome some of the stigma of the general population. But yeah, it's a huge issue, and it's definitely something that fortunately they're aware of and they're starting to try to address. But that's also, like, in terms of traditional methods, why prayer camps are so prevalent, because the religiosity within the community is seen as a way to heal. So I think that kind of almost further exacerbates issues with stigma against mental illness and against getting treatment. So that's also an issue in the sense, oh, sorry. So she asked if the family's involvement with mental illness. So one issue that we've seen that's particularly problematic is that for patients that get inpatient care, you have situations where the family will either save up money to get them, because as I said, it's all, the psychiatric hospitals are all clustered in the south of Ghana. So they either save up money, drop the patient off, don't come back. That's why some of the inpatients end up having very long stays, because the family kind of, not disowns them, but they're shut off. So that's the problem. We actually had some of the, and I can't remember if it was a nurse or just someone that worked in the ward, but she told us the fact that they've actually done things where they might contact the family and say, oh, the patient has died, you need to come pick up the remains, just to get the family back, to get them out of the inpatient ward. So it's, you know, the stigma is manifested from the family, from the community, unfortunately from all over.
And Ms. Matumba, I was wondering if there was in your another way forward, if there was a plan to include people like the teachers in helping these students with some of their issues in medications. It seems to me that the teachers and the nurses would be a good group to kind of involve in some of the issues in them taking their medications.
The question?
No.
Yeah, but it's very difficult for me to make a decision on whether, I think in the ideal world you'd like teachers to be trained. I think they would really benefit quite a lot from some training, especially on how to support children with HIV, but also to destigmatize them. But I also worry about that confidentiality, because teachers as individuals have some personality shortfalls, if I would put it that way. That, first of all, themselves, they're not remote from the communities in which they are residing, so they do also have some very stigmatizing attitudes. And given their experiences of adolescence, where they've come to a clinic and complained about teachers really harassing them because of their status, or having your HIV status announced during the school assembly, I really hesitate. I think it's on an individual basis where you have to really do an assessment with a teacher to see, would it be wise for the adolescent to disclose? So the adolescent has to make that decision. Can they trust the teachers? There have been incidences where teachers have been disclosed to, and they're really supportive of the students. But there have also been instances where teachers are told and they really go out and disclose, you know. So it's very difficult, and I would say I think it's a very, on an individual basis, where you would have to make that decision and not as a policy.
Are there any questions? Any further questions? Go ahead.
Yeah, everything we do is evidence-based. This is cognitive behavioral therapy. It's six sessions, and the answer is yes. Okay. Yes. Gee, that's an excellent question. It really is. There's an awful lot of misery in the world. We've looked at, we have been in Rwanda and Haiti with PIH for a number of years, and then after the earthquake, things got so big that they brought it in-house. We were in Liberia for a couple of years, and they weren't ready yet. They weren't quite ready. Right now, we don't know exactly which way we're going. With Dr. Betancourt in Sierra Leone, and I was there spring of this year, that's a definite possibility. On the other hand, the lake countries of East Africa are moving toward one economy, one government, and there is a group of psychiatrists from Makerere, from Nairobi, from Muhimbili in Tanzania, and we're thinking perhaps what we're going to do is regionalize. It's an old boy network. They've known each other for years and years. They will adopt the model, our model, and this may be the no-brainer for us. So.
You and Dr.
Kennedy.
You can both answer. How's that? Come on up here.
Oh, sorry.
I think your voice was loud enough that everybody heard you. Yep.
Yeah. All right. So, Ashley, I think that's a really good question, and I'm trying to formulate my thoughts for clarity with regards to it. You know, I think kind of the first point to take away is we can't just say, here are some Western definitions. They apply perfectly regardless of the context. It's just not correct. I don't, you know. You have to take, and I think as your comment brought, you have to take cultural elements, religiosity, especially in Ghana where religion is a huge thing, like that must be taken into account. Stepping back for a second, when I think in terms of even before getting into the minutia of classifications for schizophrenia or depression, I think about the morbidity effect. So these people, you're seeing negative effects on their health. And I think before we even get into categorization, that's a problem. So not even going in with a westernized definition, but there's something that needs to be addressed to improve these individuals' health, I think you can go in with. In terms of schizophrenia, you know, or I guess, like, we've talked with people that work in prayer camps. We've talked with psychiatric workers and even people within the Ministry of Health. And one thing that comes up is, you know, if you're hearing voices and you're at a prayer camp, and so as part of the way to deal with that, you're chained to a wall or you're starved, I don't think that's necessarily the best method for removing those voices, and I would argue that starvation probably would consider or lead to more delusions. So I think going at it with the necessary or the minutiae might not be the best way, but I do think there are kind of a common sense of symptomatology relevant to a schizophrenic that it's worth trying to address those through psychotropic medications. I think that you have to take cultural values into context. I think you also have to, kind of that was one thing I was saying that is important in the idea of regulation and monitoring. Are the use of these types of medications, A, helping the patients with the symptoms that they have, Are they still feasible within the society and the constraints that they live in? So I think that, to try to summarize my random cluster of thoughts, I think that it can be used in the sense that, like, the definitions we have in Western culture and the medications or the processes that we've seen to be effective in a loose sense can be brought over, but I think that you cannot ignore the cultural context, and that has to be taken into account and used to refine in terms of diagnoses, in terms of treatment, and in terms of looking at a holistic approach to the health of the patients that are seen. So I hope that gets it.
So the healthcare providers, do they use the language of Western medicine in terms of schizophrenia, or do they sort of weave in local beliefs and culture and things into their assessments?
So I can't speak to all over, but to my experience with healthcare providers within Ghana, I say it's now becoming more of a combination. Like, I think they previously used a very different language, we'll say approach, but in recent years, with I think westernized models of training becoming pervasive, you know, in Africa or people going, you know, to Western countries for training, I think that model has become more utilized. And even you know, and I think there are pros and cons to it, like a pro in the sense of getting an idea of the burden of disease because they're uniformly using ICD-10 codes is helpful, because I think if you have an idea of the burden, you can get more money, you can get more support for treatment. But I don't think even in Ghana, among psychiatric health workers, both psychiatrists and psychiatric nurses, some of the traditional thoughts and elements are out of play yet. I think they're still factored in terms of decision making and treatment for patients. Yes, it is still very common in Ghana, so that can't be ignored.
But they did just pass the mental health.
Yes, very exciting.
About 2 years ago, right?
Yeah, it just went into effect.
Which is a major.
It's a huge accomplishment in Ghana. They passed the mental health bill, and there's a lot of, I think, elements in terms of addressing stigma that are part of it, looking to kind of get over to using the the medicine that might be used west, but also not ignoring the role of traditional healing and its implications and benefits. So really, they're being very proactive in Ghana. It's a very exciting time, I think, to see what changes can develop. So, sorry.
You've put your finger on something that is a really bitter argument. Especially, there are a group called the transcultural psychiatrists that, you know, believe that this is all hype. You know, that we've medicalized human misery. And we don't really want to be in that argument, frankly, because we're not 1,000% sure, to tell you the truth. The dictum, PTSD, is, I have a friend who was the father of PTSD in Uganda. Okay, when he sat for his master's, I mean, for his specialty, they flunked him. Because he gave it on PTSD. He did his dissertation on PTSD, and they said, no, that's a construct that comes from Western Vietnam veterans, and we don't have this here in Africa. And it took him a couple of years to educate his examiners that, yes, you do have it, okay? It's just expressed differently. In Liberia, for example, depression often is expressed as a hole, an open mole, a hole in your head through which spirits come and go. Also in Cambodia, the genesis of mental distress is because the household gods are either mad at you or have deserted you. In Uganda, we found that patients who had mild to moderate depression got better with two groups, and couldn't figure it out. I mean, this is psychoeducation. This is really low level stuff, and we said, you know, why? And it took Uganda, my program, Africa program director, who's an MD PhD. He said, look, the minute you take it out of the spiritual world, these people are not sleeping, not because they are being pursued by either their relatives who they haven't buried properly or people that they were made to kill. Okay. Rather, it is something that no human they experience something that no human being should have to see, and it's universal. Okay. These are the things that you know bring it back. I think cultural context trumps everything. Okay. I also think that you know schizophrenia does exist in Africa. There's no doubt in my mind. Okay. But how well the patient its quality of life rises has an awful lot to do with the determinants of social determinants. So psychosocial signs of this are really terribly important because they are, you can employ them, you just can't employ them in 9 to 5. Okay? They can contribute to society and they can have what the WHO calls good mental health, okay, despite their symptoms. So. There's a meandering for you, a wandering for you.
Are there any other questions? Yes.
Given the lack of the big ratio of psychiatric providers to the population and for most of the developing world, are you aware of any initiatives to train more lay mental health professionals?
Well, in Uganda, we train mid-level professionals. I was just at a conference in Portugal where they talked about this gap, the treatment gap, and the lack of professionals. And what they calculated, this is fabulous, in Africa is that given the number, the need, okay, versus the number of psychiatrists, everybody in Africa, no matter what, has 5 seconds worth of psychiatry. Okay? That's what you get, 5 seconds worth of talk. So now take this system and say, okay, we're going to increase this by tenfold. Well, now everybody has 50 seconds. Can't do it. All right. So, obviously, what you have to do is shift the task down. Okay? Is you train and then you supervise. There are not enough psychiatrists, there are not enough psychiatric nurses. You train and you supervise your mid-level professionals, we think. And then they train and supervise community health workers. Okay? It's tricky. It is not a great model. Okay? This train and train and train. It's like a game of telephone. You know, did you ever sit at the Thanksgiving table and you say, hi, my name's Steve, and watch you go around the table, it, you know, comes back and says, I have no name, you know. So you've really got to train, supervise. We manualize, too, to answer. We used to have, for a same diagnosis in our 4 clinics in Uganda, we'd have different treatments. We said, no, you can't do that. Okay, we manualize our treatment, and we train them on it, and we make sure that they can do it. I mean, this is if you try to do this without a public health approach, it's going to fail. It's got to fail. Yeah, we're probably not going back, okay? Our efforts in Liberia, you see, in our other countries, what we do is we treat patients, okay? Our model is we partner with the government by MOU, by contract, okay? So we don't work outside of them. And our deal is they put up the clinical space, the inpatient bed, psychotropic drugs. We do the training supervision, okay, of indigenous people only. Okay, Liberia had so few professionals. They had one psychiatrist. Yeah, so we brought a psychiatrist in, an MD, PhD from Uganda, from Makera, and we began to train cohorts of nurses. The problem is there's no way to supervise them. And it wasn't a good use of of our personnel, I don't think. Sure, we'd go back, I mean, if circumstances changed. I mean, we're running what they called wellness clinics. If you know Liberia, it was in Long County at Phoebe Hospital. So, Walter, you know Walter, of course.
Yes.
It's just there is no way to propagate the system. Just our deal is, the deal with the government is, at the end of 10 years, let us go. Okay, now you know how to do it. Take mental health component and wrap it into your package of primary health care. I mean, this is who should be giving it, not an NGO from the West. You know, all we are, you know, we implement policy, locally made policy. I mean, that's what we do.
Thank you.
Thank you.